Tonight, the last of my talks on karma. I think one of the most important things to say about karma, and I said this before, but I want to emphasize it, what's the Dalai Lama said when he asked which is more important, the teachings on emptiness or the teachings on karma, and he said karma. So I think I asked this question before, and I'll ask it again. Why do you think he said that? Anybody have any idea? Yeah.
My thought is that that has to do with our actions in the world. That emptiness, I think, can help us individually, but the karma has to do with the good things that result, the bad things that result from our moment-by-moment thoughts and speech and activities, and that's the meat of our existence.
I think you're absolutely right, and I just got this issue of Buddha Dharma magazine, very good magazine, and there was a short essay by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I'm just going to read the last two paragraphs of it, and it's along the lines of what you just said. We're living in confusing times, and we're living in very challenging times. And I'll read what he says. In each historical period, the Dharma finds new means to unfold its potential in ways precisely linked to that era's distinctive historical conditions. I believe that our own era provides the appropriate historical stage for the transcendent truth of the Dharma to bend back upon the world and engage human suffering at multiple levels, even the lowest, harshest, and most degrading levels, not in a mere contemplative state, but in effective, relief-granting action illuminated by its own world-transcending goal. Along the lines of what you said, the special challenge facing Buddhism in our age is to stand up as an advocate for justice in the world, a voice of conscience for those victims of social, economic, and political injustice who cannot stand up and speak for themselves. This, in my view, is a deeply moral challenge, marking a watershed in the modern expression of Buddhism. I believe it also points in a direction that Buddhism has to take to share the Buddha's ongoing mission to humanity. So this is why I have been talking about karma, exactly for that reason, because I think it is so important for us to be aware of what we are doing in the world now more than ever. So in the West, we generally have, and I'm going to just review my first two talks very quickly first, we have a general misunderstanding of karma. And you have heard people say, well, look what's happening to him or her. It's their karma. They deserve it because their karma. Or that person, boy, that's going to come around and karma's going to get them. That's what's going to happen. Like we really know, you know, what's going to take place. And one of the essays I read said, you can't use karma like a rear view mirror, like you think you know what's going on. It is much too complicated, and the Buddha talked about the four imponderables, and karma is one of them. These are the things that will drive you to madness and vexation, to use his words. In other words, they'll drive you insane trying to figure them out. The other ones are the mind of a Buddha, the beginning of things, and the power of a concentrated mind. None of these can you just sit and decipher by speculation and trying to figure it out. So I read a very interesting sutta, which I'm not going to quote much of because it's very long, and it was so confusing to me, I had to read it a couple of times. And it starts off with a very convoluted question by a lay practitioner about karma, and how only mental karma is most important, or something like that. And he got an equally convoluted answer back from a monk. And then another party said, let's go to the Buddha and find out about this, because none of this is sounding right. So they went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, well, you're all being ridiculous. That's a ridiculous question, and that's a ridiculous answer. You can't figure these things out. And then he said, for example, there are four types of people in the world. And this is what I kept reading over, going, am I reading this right? The evildoer who goes to hell, the evildoer who goes to heaven, the good man who goes to heaven, and the good man who goes to hell. Well, what does that supposed to mean? I'm thinking it's a typo or something. And the whole point he was making is the minds of people and our actions are so complex that we really don't know what is going to take place. And the only area, which I'll go into in just a minute, where we have any control is when?
Present moment.
That's right. This is why we are always emphasizing teachers and sitting meditation, come back to the present moment. This is where you can make a difference. Only then. That's it. And that will influence the future. So, essentially, he's saying the minds of people are too complex to try to figure out. And the actions often don't make sense when we think someone's getting away with something. I was thinking of O.J. Simpson as I was writing this out. And I remember how, for me, I was really upset when he got off. But look at what happened with his life. And then I thought, what if he had turned around after being freed and just created all kinds of good karma for himself? Imagine what a difference that would have made. Instead, he kept that same momentum going of selfishness and greed and that kind of thing. So we don't know what's going to ultimately happen to him, but he certainly had karma showing up in this lifetime, watching the results of those actions. And I'll be going into killing in just a little bit. So the definition of karma just means action. That's all it is. It's not a big mysterious thing. And in the Buddha's time, there were all kinds of views on karma. Most people believed in karma, but they had different ideas of what took place. Some people thought everything is preordained. No matter what you do, it's preordained and nothing's going to change. Other people said there's an ongoing soul that goes from lifetime to lifetime, and that is permanent, and that's what affects karma. Others said something else, the nihilist and the eternalist, and the Buddha said you're all wrong. All of you are wrong because you're all speculating. And unless you experience yourself what karma is, this is all speculation. And he said, as a Buddha, I did. I saw karma, and I saw how it works, and it's lawful. I declare, O bhikkhus, that volition is karma, having willed one acts by body, speech, and thought. So karma is all actions of body, speech, and thought, all of them. As we act, it's called vipaka, and the fruit of that action is called phala. And sometimes we can see it, and sometimes we cannot. Actions are wholesome, which is called kusala, or they're unwholesome, which is called akusala. And that's kind of what I'll be talking about tonight. And there's also called, well, kusala and akusala could also be called bright and dark karma. So you can generate bright and dark karma, and you can generate karma that is neither bright or dark. And I think that's what a lot of us do in our just habitual activity, is we're not even aware of what we're doing. It might be bright, it might be dark, but this is what I always do, and I don't think about it, and, you know, and life rolls on with us not having any control at all, even though we have the ability to control, but we don't take advantage of it, which is the whole purpose of coming to this group or any other meditation group and mindfulness group, is to start getting control. So intention is what karma is based on. What are we going to do right this minute? So if you were in an accident and you caused harm, would that be akusala karma, negative karma for you, dark karma? if you were in an accident and caused harm, what kind of karma would you accrue?
Depends on your intention, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, what kind of karma would you accrue?
Well, what do you mean by accident?
An accident. You caused an accident. Was it your intention to cause that accident?
Oh, no.
It was not. That's right. So, according to the law of karma, since that was not your intention to harm, there would be no karmic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a draw. Yeah.
But it occurred because you were not mindful.
That was going to be my next. In, you're thinking ahead of me. I was going to say, what if you were texting and driving and caused an accident? Not intentional? Okay.
But heedless.
It's heedlessness, that's right.
Or drunk driving.
Well, yeah, exactly. So where does that lie? Anybody know?
That's intentional. That's where the wholesome actions, practicing wholesome actions.
That's exactly right. This is an unwholesome action. The amount of karma, again, the Buddha said, we can't figure it out. It's certainly not wholesome. Something is going to happen. It wasn't intentional, but it certainly was heedless and not being concerned about your life or the life of others. So how much karmic weight? Yeah.
You know, it certainly was intentional to be texting and driving
mm-hmm.
when you know it's wrong.
Yeah, exactly, and that's heedlessness. Yeah, and but we can't speculate how much karmic weight. It's kind of that in between, neither light nor dark, and what takes place, you know, who knows. You can also have mixed motives, and I'm sure you can all think of mixed motives. And I know one guy in our prison sangha, and I've told you this before. We were studying generosity, and he very happily went around doing generous acts for others. And I had asked people to notice their emotions when they did that. You know, there should be an uplifting feeling when you perform kind acts for others. And he came back and he said, I didn't have an uplifting feeling. No one thanked me. I thought I'd get something from them. No one did anything back for me. He was missing the whole point. But that is a mixed motive. Because, yeah, he did something that might have benefited others, but he was expecting a result. He was planning it all out, as it should be.
So I have a question, though, about the idea of karma, because there seems to be an assumption that karma will come later,
mm-hmm.
but it may come much later, but if you accidentally, while texting, caused an accident, really, would it count that you're going to have all kinds of karma right away? I mean, you're probably going to have people, mm-hmm. you're certainly going to have people angry, upset with you, maybe you're going to be sued, maybe it's going to cost you a lot of money. And hopefully you're going to feel badly about it,
mm-hmm.
and suffer eternally. I would think that's part of the karma.
Maybe. I don't know. That's speculation. I think we've all seen things that took place and there was an immediate repercussion afterwards, and we say, yeah, that's karma happening. Well, it looks like it, and maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. You know, it's speculation. It's satisfying when you see somebody get what you think they should get, and it's very unsatisfying when you think somebody gets away with something.
Or it's you and you suffer because you just
do right.
Because your actions are going to lead to suffer.
That's right. That's right. So it's a very interesting topic, and not one, unless we are completely enlightened and can see the workings of the world in our own minds completely, we don't know. But we can do the best we can in the present moment, which is going to be mostly what I'm going to be talking about. To complicate things even more, the Buddha said there's 5 types of karma, and we only have control over one. So the 5 types of karma, and this is very scientific, actually. One of them has got to do with seeds, genetics. You know, you were born with a skin color and hair color and maybe a predisposition towards a personality. That's all genetics. You have no control over that. That's just what happened. The seasons, you have no control over the seasons and the weather. The next one is karma niyama. That's the one you have control over. And that is only in the present moment, that little space of time. There's when you have control. And the last one is called citta niyama, and I was just talking to Terry, who's an expert on quantum physics. And citta...
That's a joke.
And she was talking about quantum physics. But citta niyama is the unknown. Things that happen that we have no idea why they're happening, or they might not make sense. And I think citta niyama, quantum physics, would fit into that category. You know, why when you look at something, it changes the way it is just by looking at it. This doesn't make sense, but it happens. So it's yet to be found out. So karma niyama, the only karma we have control over, one aspect in one moment. So tonight we're going to talk about the 10 wholesome and the 10 unwholesome actions. And that was in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book on pages 156 to 161, in case you do want to go back and read it. And it's a useful checklist just to see how you're doing. What's going on? You know, in different situations, are you acting skillfully, creating kusala karma, or unskillfully, akusala karma? So the first three are actions of the body. The next four are verbal actions, and the last three are actions of the mind. And with the 10 wholesome and unwholesome actions, we're also introducing, the Buddha introduced merit, which I'm going to also be talking about, which is called punya in Pali. And it's not such a common practice here in the West, although at the end of many of our Dharma talks, we will dedicate the merit, you know, to all living beings. In Asian Buddhist countries, it's much, much more practiced. It's a daily life practice. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So merit can be defined as actions of thought, words, and deeds which purify and cleanse the mind. And the basis of merit are giving, virtue, and mental development. The 10 wholesome actions create merit, but are also spoken of in terms of karma. So the 10 wholesome actions are really similar to the precepts. In fact, the first four are the first four precepts. Only the fifth one is missing. I was curious, so why do we have the separate list? Well, he did add the three mental components at the end, which we'll talk about. But I also think sila, which is right action, virtuous conduct, we practice the precepts to create safety for others. The emphasis is on creating safety for others. So I will not harm or kill living beings, the first one. That's safety for others. I will train in not stealing. These are all training, not commandments. I will train in not stealing. Again, safety for others. I will not engage in sexual misconduct. You know, so families are safe. I will not engage in lying, so people can trust you. And I will not engage in taking intoxicants which lead to heedlessness. That's the only one that comes back to us, and that's not in this list, which is interesting. So I think the precepts, at least my understanding, is safety in the world. Those of you who've gone on retreat know how nice it is to be in a place where you can leave things out. You don't worry about having people take things or having people gossip about you. There's no sexual misconduct. I mean, it's just a safe container, and it's such a treasure to be in. The 10 wholesome actions, on the other hand, are what purifies the mind. So it's the same thing, but our concern now is what is happening in our own minds when we do or do not do these various actions. And the opposite of merit is demerit, called papa in Pali. And the good news in Buddhist practice is merit overcomes demerit. And this is really excellent news, because if it wasn't, predestination would happen. It would just mean you do something bad, that's it. You know, you're sunk. Nothing can be done about that. No getting over it. So demerit can be undone by meritorious actions. And I know those of us who go into prison, we wouldn't go in there if that wasn't possible, because there's so much suffering, there's so much remorse, there's so much guilt. And yeah, we tell them, you're starting over right now in this present moment. This is the beginning. And there's hope. So merit is cultivated differently in different cultures. It can be practiced externally and internally. You know, Asian Buddhist countries, they practice much more externally. At least they did for years and years. And I know when I've spoken to the nuns about their time at Amaravati in England, they talked about these Thai Buddhist people who lived in England would just shower them with wonderful food and cakes and gifts, shaving creams, because they all shave their heads, you know, and nice razors, and, you know, whatever they could do. This was their creating merit for themselves by doing good for someone else. And the Buddha said it is especially auspicious to do good for a monastic, somebody who is a renunciant. These people were so devoted. Ajahn Chah, whose lineage in Thailand was the starting of Amaravati in England, not only sent monks and nuns there to start this in the Western world, he sent lay people there so they would support these monks and nuns, because he knew in England nobody knew about Buddhism or, you know, Dana, and people would, well, like, go hungry. You know, they wouldn't have a roof over their heads. So he sent lay people along with the monks and nuns to support them. And there's a story of one person who lives very near Amaravati who started a pub, which is interesting. And the monks and nuns would do their alms round at this pub, because this Thai person owned it, and that's what he could do to make a living. And so his merit was making sure that they had food every day at lunch when they came into the pub. You know, all the books that we receive, you know, when the nuns come and they leave out all these nice books for us, all of that is dana, mostly from Asian communities. In other traditions, it's the same thing. At one of the prisons I go into, DVI, there's a monastic who comes in only two or three times a year, but he has a huge lay following. And he asked the prisoners at this institution, so what do you need? And they said, well, we need yoga mats, and we'd like a nice rug, and we'd like some really good books. They got all of that, and they got the nice yoga mats, you know, the really big, thick ones that you could sleep on. Rug, absolutely gorgeous rugs to put the yoga mats on, and all kinds of books. And this is all due to lay followers of this monk. Their merit is making sure that he gets what he asks for. And they follow him around and say, what do you need now? This is external merit. Sometimes it's done also for yourself, hoping karma will bless you with good results because of the merit you're accruing. And sometimes it's considered way more propitious if you don't ask for anything. But being human beings, I'm sure many people hope that something good will come out of all of this, and, you know, my kids will be safe or whatever. So in the United States, when Western Buddhism first came here, we did not adopt the tradition of the Asian Buddhist. I think because we were so used to going to church or temple and having a plate come around and everybody put your money inside, that's more our style. It's more our culture and what we're used to. And even our meditation practice in Asian cultures up to very recently, very few people meditated. They considered their merit coming from good works and generosity. Here, we, right from the beginning, start diving into meditation, not developing dana and generosity, but meditation instead. That is also meritous. Remember, there's three forms of merit: generosity, virtuous conduct, and mental development. So it's another form of merit. But, you know, I don't think it's as joyful. You know, the nuns say the Thai people support them are just so happy. You know, they're just so happy to be doing this. And, yeah, I think we miss out on something by not, and maybe someday we'll evolve into that. In fact, Ajahn Amaro said what's happening in the Buddhist world, he called it the pizza pie effect. And Ajahn Amaro is now the abbot at Amaravati. And he said why it's the pizza pie effect is because pizza was this peasant food from Italy that came over here. And it was, you know, just the leftovers, throw it on some dough and it's quick. It came here and we made it into something that we eat all the time. There's gourmet pizzas. And then it went back to Italy, where they now take it as a delicacy. It's become the American pizza. And it's kind of like this practice, as we were starting to get into the mental development meditation, it went back to Thailand, and now monks are teaching lay people in Thailand meditation. You can, any of you have gone to Thailand, I know many of us have, you can take meditation courses in Thailand.
Everywhere.
Yeah, and that was not maybe 20, 30 years ago. No, that didn't happen. Lay people supported the monastics, and that was their job, and the monastics did their meditation. So it's kind of moving around. Cultures are kind of intermixing. The Buddha put a lot of emphasis on panya or merit. Like I said, negative merit can be negated with positive merit. I'm going to read you a portion of this sutta where he talks about that and how important merit is. And in this sutta, he's equating, the simile is karma is salt. Okay. Now suppose a man throws a lump of salt into a small cup of water. What do you think, monks? Would that small quantity of water in the cup become salty and undrinkable through that lump of salt? It would, Lord. And why so? The water in the cup is so little that a lump of salt can make it salty and undrinkable. But suppose, monks, that lump of salt is thrown into the river Ganges. Would it make the river Ganges salty and undrinkable? Certainly not, Lord. And why not? Lord, it's due to the mass of water in the Ganges. It will not become salty and undrinkable by a lump of salt. So he's talking about merit, you know, and demerit, and we have enough merit, we build up enough goodness in our hearts and the way we act. We screw up sometimes. Well, I do. Maybe you do too. But if you've had enough merit build up, you know, it's like the salt in the Ganges. It's just not going to make that big a difference. And that might be as much as we can know about karma and its effects. Here's from the Dhammapada. Should a person perform good, he should do it again and again. He should find pleasure therein, for blissful is the accumulation of good. Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come near to me. Even by the falling of drops of water, a water jar is filled. Likewise, the wise man gathering little by little, fills himself with good. So all these little good things we do add up. So, okay, the 10 wholesome actions, and I'm going to read a little bit about the commentaries about their results, and they're surprisingly contemporary. You know, these were what people said would happen when you committed unskillful or unwholesome actions out in the world. You know, forget about the mind, which is really going to be suffering tremendously, but out in the world this is what happens too. So the killing of living beings is the first one. The first three are actions of the body. And traditionally, the commitment of this act will cause brevity of life, ill health, grief, and living in fear. Those are the mental states that accompany that. I think that's pretty accurate. I think we've seen that in prison, and I think that makes all the sense in the world. Stealing results are poverty, misery, disappointment, and a dependent livelihood. And I suppose that means nobody trusts you. You're not going to be able, you're going to be depending on the kindness of strangers to get by. And the third unwholesome bodily action, unlawful sexual intercourse. And this will result in, not surprisingly, having many enemies, being hated, and union with very unhappy wives and husbands. That's a safe bet. I mean, that's a very safe bet in an unhappy marriage. So verbal actions. And the first one, this is again the fourth of the five precepts. It's the first of the three, four verbal actions in unwholesome karma. Lying. Being subjected to abusive speech, vilification, you are not considered trustworthy, and you will become physically unpleasant. Slander and tale-bearing, you will lose your friends without sufficient cause. And I think what that's saying is you go around slandering and telling stories, and all of a sudden nobody is speaking to you, and why not? Why is everyone avoiding me? And then frivolous and, harsh speech. When you engage in that, you are detested by others and you develop a harsh voice. And then frivolous and meaningless speech ends up no one believes you. So I think these kind of have some basis in fact. And then the mental actions are, the first is covetousness. And this is desiring things that belong to others. And the undesirable result is the non-fulfillment of one's wishes. That to me makes all the sense in the world, because if you covet, the Buddha said desire never satisfies desire. And as long as you're coveting, you are never going to be happy. Because even when you get what you covet, you're going to covet something else. Desire never satisfies desire. Ill will, the consequences of ill will are ugliness, disease, and having a detestable nature, your friends will be few. And finally, wrong view, lack of wisdom, being of dull wit, having chronic disease, and blameworthy ideas. So all of these are negative karma effects. The 10 wholesome actions are the exact opposite. So what's the exact opposite of wanting to kill someone? What would be the opposite of that?
Helping living beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, compassion. Compassion for living beings. So developing compassion and benevolence, the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. I gave you this analogy before. Remember, this is creating a purity of mind and merit. And Bhikkhu Anālayo gave the example of working with this one, having compassion for living beings. And he said, what if you were, when a steak is put on your plate, you don't see it as food, but you see it as an animal who is afraid to die. That's developing compassion. I mean, that's really seeing through things to such a great depth. And that's what he challenged us to start looking at the world in that way, not just the surface, what I want and don't want, is there suffering involved or not. Stealing, what's the opposite of stealing?
Generosity.
Generosity, that's right, generosity. So when we practice generosity, we cultivate non-attachment. We understand that other people value their things, their livelihoods, and we respect them. Sexual misconduct, what is the opposite of sexual misconduct? Restraint. And not engaging in sexual misconduct cultivates restraint and renunciation and a happy partnership. Your partner's going to be very happy that you're not cheating on them. Lying, what's the opposite of lying? Telling the truth, honesty. One of the ways I think being honest is really important, especially for those of us who are up front or anybody who's leading groups, is being willing to say, I don't know. You know, sometimes it's really hard to do that, but to be able to say, I don't know, I don't have the answer for that, that I think is one of the really great things about honesty. Anyway, my own personal opinion. Slander, the opposite of slander, trustworthiness. Speaking kindly of others allows us to not worry about others, what others are saying about us. The Buddha in the Sigalavada Sutta talks about good friends, and he said a good friend, when not in your company, will talk about your virtues. Your good friend will never divulge anything about you that you have said in confidence. So that's what this is talking about, too. Harsh speech, the opposite is gentle language, not perpetuating hostility with harsh language or, you know, flipping people off, doing things like that. Does that ever solve anything? It just perpetuates it. Hate is never solved by hate. Only by non-hate is hate solved. So actually just putting a stop to it, if nothing else, just I'm not going to respond to that in the way that I might feel like, but thinking of what is wholesome and unwholesome and best for me and my mental attitude, I'm not going to respond to that. Idle chatter, the satisfaction of having spiritual friends where you can have deep, meaningful conversations. So I think all of you have had wonderful conversations with dear friends, maybe about your practice or about ethical questions, and those are so deep and so meaningful and so important. And if you engage constantly in just idle chit-chat, you're not going to be able to engage in those kind of conversations. So that's why I thought, the satisfaction of spiritual friends when we don't engage in idle chatter. Covetousness, back to the mental actions, satisfaction with what one has, and maybe even the desire to give things away. Am I the only one who's got this desire to just get rid of stuff? Anybody else have a desire to just raise your hand? Yeah. And I don't know if it comes with age or practice or what it is, but I just can't get rid of stuff fast enough. I'm so glad this garage sale is going on. It's going to be very, very helpful. And ill will, opposite of ill will, is?
Goodwill.
That's right, goodwill, benevolence, metta, loving kindness. And I think a way of working with this is when we start developing ill will, remembering everybody has a story to tell. Everybody has something going on in their lives that we have no idea about. And we might have an initial reaction of dislike or hatred or animosity. But how many times has something happened to you where you found out later about that person and wonder, God, how did they do what they've been doing? What a rough life. I had a very embarrassing thing happen at the very first SIM retreat. Well, the judging mind was coming up big time, and it was interesting noticing the judging minds coming up. And I would sit down, and this woman kept moving right in front of me. And no matter, I'd sit here, she seemed to move in front there, and she was in a chair, and I was really, really annoyed. And she'd move closer and closer, so no matter where I sat, I couldn't see the speaker. And it was John Travis and Dennis who were putting it on. So I finally went to the retreat manager, and I said, "Well, this woman is just completely annoying. She moves way up front, and she's blocking the view, and I can't see." And the guy who was the retreat manager, a man named John Scott, who no longer lives around here, wonderful man, said, "Diane, be patient. She's deaf. And she's trying to get, and her hearing aid has not been working well, and she's trying to get as close as she can." Oh, God. That was one of the best lessons in not holding on to a view. I can't tell you, in having benevolence. And then wrong view, what's the opposite of wrong view?
Right view.
Right view, that's right. And right view is actually not clinging to a view. How many of us cling to views? Exactly what I... We all cling to views. And to be able to let go of views, just like I had to do, or I was forced to, fortunately, in that situation, I thought I had it all together. I had no idea what was going on. I had wrong view. And we have this happen all the time as we decide this is the way the world is. So again, back to the present moment, we always consider with mindfulness and thoughtfulness and benevolence what is taking place. Do I really know? Yes.
So I think probably been coming up for a lot of people lately, discerning between wisdom and view or opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of walking that fine line. Like, I think it's wisdom that all people should be treated equally. But it's a view that I don't like Nazis. Is that that? Okay. So holding on to the wisdom of treating people fairly and equally, letting go of the I hate Nazis.
And this is out in the world. If we see harm being caused, my own opinion is we do what we can to protect people who don't deserve to have harm happen to them. And I think that's about as far as I can go. As far as wisdom, this is why we have a meditation practice, because the Buddha said we're all wise and compassionate in our hearts. We have buried all of that with our views, our upbringing, our this, our that. And meditation allows those to fall away and wisdom emerge. So it's a very difficult situation that you're talking about. And we don't combat hatred with more hatred, but we do what we can to protect others. And I think that's about the wisdom, best wisdom I can come up with, you know, at this point. I know on Facebook, I just can't get into the whole, even the rants against the Nazi people. I just find this isn't helping anything. It's amping up. I mean, if they're causing harm, they come to Sacramento, and I will be out marching, but I don't want to be on Facebook just one discussion after another about how awful this is. I'm not solving anything. I'm just amping up my own ill will. So unless I can do something, I mean, that's just for me. But
that's very helpful.
I hope. So mindfulness of these basic guidelines helps us see what we should do, how we show up skillfully or not, where we actually think about it, and it's our own mental attitudes that we're taking control of. That's what the 10 wholesome and 10 unwholesome actions are addressing. And the Buddha himself, an enlightened being, and I have thought about this frequently, doesn't mean that he wasn't subjected to unwholesome thoughts. And the reason I don't think that's what it means is because Mara visited him constantly, was always testing him. If they were gone completely, why would Mara is greed, hatred, and delusion visiting. And he had perfected these actions so well that they just immediately protected him. But Mara would still visit. You know, it would still happen. There's a series on Netflix, I've told some of you about it, it's called Buddha. It's 53 parts. It was made in India. It's in Hindi. It's a little, for lack of a better word, Bollywoodish, but it's very interesting. It really is interesting because you see how people lived then. I mean, they film a lot of it in ruins, you know, and the dress and the manner of speaking and everything. I find it fascinating. I'm on episode 40 now. And Devadatta, his archenemy, his cousin, is just, you know, the archenemy. But one of the things that happens in it, they have this young man playing the Buddha who is gorgeous. I mean, he is gorgeous. And he becomes enlightened, okay? Then all of a sudden he has this continual half-smile and never shows any emotion. After this, he's just walking around like this all the time, no matter what happens, and it kind of loses its drama. So I know, I mean, I've read enough suttas to know the Buddha got mad at people. He called people fools. He would get upset if you misinterpreted the Dharma, you foolish man. He even got mad at Ananda, you know, his attendant who adored him. It would tell him in front of everybody else, not so, Ananda, not so. So, you know, Mara visits all of us. He just knew what to do. He knew how far he could go. He loved the people he was with. But Mara still visited. So I'm beginning to see enlightenment in a completely different way. Not perfection, but knowing exactly what to do in all circumstances to create Kusala karma. So I'm going to wrap up very soon. What happens when we commit an unskillful act? Well, according to Buddhism, there is no act that is beyond redemption. And it is not, you've heard me talk about this, forgiveness. Buddhism is a karmic religion. There is no deity to forgive you. You have to take care of your own karma. You can, and the only place I think I spoke about this last time, where there is forgiveness, it's called pardoning rather than forgiveness. So you have to forgive yourself because you have created meritorious actions to undo the unwholesome actions. I told you about one guy in one of our sanghas, and he had murdered somebody who was a Buddhist. And he has extreme remorse. And I believe about 10 years he was into his life sentence, he became a Buddhist himself as an act of merit because he said he will live the life that his victim couldn't. And he started sending dana to the temple where where his victim went. And I just spoke to him Tuesday night, as a matter of fact. And he still has tremendous amount of guilt because he's going to go up for parole and the family does not forgive him. And he is anguished over this. And he asked me about it and I told him, that's their karma. You have done everything you can to create merit for yourself and for your victim. That's all you can do. You have no control over somebody else. If they decide to forgive you, they will find that their life is much easier than holding on to hate. and ill will. But that's not for you to determine. That's up for the, up to them. And he said that was helpful. I hope it was helpful. I don't know, because the remorse and the guilt he's experiencing is tremendous. Ajahn Suchito gave 5 steps when you worry about karma. You've done an unskillful act. You admit the act fully, so you don't blame anyone else. You don't look for another place to, well, it's kind of my fault and kind of his fault. No, what's your fault is your fault. It doesn't matter what somebody else did. You know if this caused harm to yourself or others. Know completely the emotion that propelled that act. There's always an emotion that was there. Was it jealousy, anger, fear? What was it? Know it completely. Know it in the body. Understand and practice the antidote when that emotion appears. So if it's hatred, it's metta. It's benevolence. And every time that hatred comes up, you will actually wish that person well to the point where that replaces hatred. When it starts coming up, immediately metta. That's what the Buddha did. Over and over until it just became rote. No matter what Mara did, this is what came up. And then make the intention that this act will never happen again. And if appropriate, ask for forgiveness. This isn't asking forgiveness of a god or anything. It's if appropriate, ask forgiveness of, in this case, the victim's family. Time of death is in a very auspicious time to rectify akusala karma. Why do you think that is? Anybody have a guess? Why at the time of death would this be a really good time to develop merit? And akusala karma and merit are pretty much the same thing. I can't find a difference. So why do you think that is?
Last chance.
Well, that's a good point. It is a last chance. But why would the mind be malleable or open to it?
Because you're having to let everything go anyway.
Yeah, that's right. How many people, those of us who have spent time with people who are dying, how much ease when they can let go there is, and when you remind them of the skillful things they have done in their lives? There's no holding on anymore. What's to hold on to? Yeah, it is letting go. You know, what am I going to hold on to? Hate? I'm going to hold on to, I can't stand my sister? Really? No, it's letting go. And this is when skillful karma, you've left this wide open field, and skillful karma, skillful merit can take place. This is why when you're with dying people, you always remind them of the good they have done in life. You want them to die with a really solid, happy, at ease feeling about their lives. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, "The last moment of this life will condition the next moment of the next life, if you happen to believe in rebirth. If you don't, doesn't matter." But that's what he said. And finally, I'm going to end with a safe bet. What if there is rebirth? What if there's not? Rich gave the talk on the Kalama Sutta, and at the end, it was the same ending. You know, if you lead a good life and follow the 10 wholesome actions, you're going to have a much happier life. Went through all the detriments when you don't. Who wants to have a mind, you know, that has no friends, that you're constantly worried about what people are going to say? I mean, you know, it's endless. So if you lead a wholesome life, it's going to be a happy life. So much happier. And if there is a next life, Thich Nhat Hanh is right, the last moment of this life is the first moment of the next, you're starting off in a really good place. You can't go wrong. So the Buddha called it a safe bet. Live wholesomely. And that's the end of my talk. So, anybody have any questions or comments?
I had one, but I forgot it.
All right. Well, it's 9:02 anyway, so we will, it's been a long day. So let's do a final dedication of merit. May the merit we generated tonight be given away freely to all living beings, and especially those that are suffering, that do not feel part of society, that feel belittled. May the merit of our practice go to them. May it bring joy and ease of being and happiness and safety. And may all of us in this room engage in wholesome actions so that we, in this lifetime, will know complete freedom. Thank you all for coming.